Morning. We have three cases scheduled for argument this morning, and we understand counsel in all three have announced ready and declared the time that they wish to take the argument. So that being the case, we'll call Ray Gilbert versus State of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Gilbert was convicted of unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon. The indictment in his case set forth what purported to be two counts, and that is important because under our law, under the Code of Criminal Procedure, as explained in Callens v. State, which is actually cited in the state's brief, a count is the portion of an indictment that sets forth a particular offense. And paragraphs in an indictment set forth different manners and means for committing an offense. So if you have a count that sets forth a statutory offense, you may have an infinite number of paragraphs that set forth the different ways to commit that particular statutory offense. But in an indictment, separate counts are at least supposed to charge separate statutory offenses. And in this case, until the trial court sua sponte changed the counts to paragraphs at the charging conference, every legal person that looked at this case treated them as separate offenses and counts. The assistant district attorney who indicted the case indicted them as separate counts, thereby indicating that they were separate statutory offenses. The assistant district attorney who arraigned Mr. Gilbert, both outside the presence of the jury and in front of the jury, and asked him how he pled, arraigned him on counts and asked how he pled to the offense in count one and the offense in count two.
Under your theory, though, wouldn't the jury have had to have been able to find him guilty of both counts? Which, under the facts as it was tried, wouldn't that have been impossible?
I think that if they had submitted it correctly, that if it had been submitted correctly and the cases had been the counts had been submitted in the disjunctive, and again, we're not challenging the sufficiency of the evidence. Basically from a factual standpoint, if you believe Mr. Gilbert, he didn't touch the gun. If you believe the officer, he did. So that comes down to a swearing match between the witnesses, which really I don't know how that plays into the analysis of our legal claim. If they had correctly submitted it, I would say that the jury could have convicted him of both, but there would have been a multiple punishments double jeopardy bar to him being punished for them both. And I think what would have had to happen at that time is they would have submitted both of them to, and I can't remember if Judge Westfall or the jury assessed Mr. Gilbert's punishment. They would have assessed punishment on both cases, and then the remedy would have been to delete the lesser punishment.
Counsel, can you distinguish this case from the Gall, the Dallas case, Gall v. State, and our case, Riley v. State?
And I believe those
both
cases,
of which were cases involving mislabeling manner and means as counts.
What I would say is that, first off, the Court of Criminal Appeals has never directly addressed that. And I would say that to some extent they're not distinguishable other than obviously different statutory offenses were involved. And that in a situation where there is not clear authority one way or the other about whether or not you're talking about separate statutory offenses. And I think if you look at both our brief and the state's brief, what you find out is that no court has ever addressed whether 4601A1 and 4601A2 are different offenses. Ms. Faulkner and I were discussing a recent Court of Criminal Appeals case from October 8th of this year that talks about conduct offenses. It's about aggravated assault. But this is about result offenses. You intentionally or knowingly cause a result. This is a conduct offense. And I don't think there has ever been a case that directly addresses in a conduct offense when you have a statutory scheme the way this is set out, whether or not they're separate offenses. And I think under that case, when the state makes the choice about how that indictment is drafted, and when they elect to proceed on it as counts, the defendant is arraigned on it as counts. The clerk's office, if you look at the proceedings for the days when he was arraigned, he pled not guilty to counts one and two. It is treated as separate statutory offenses throughout the trial until this charge conference. And then to go from that to unilaterally submitting it as converting those counts to paragraphs, we believe was erroneous. And I would say that while the case is not distinguishable from the 1986 case from the Dallas Court of Appeals or the subsequent case from this court, that if you just apply the law of indictments as set forth in Callens and the Code of Criminal Procedure, we had separate counts, and that showed that they were separate statutory offenses.
Seems to me that would just elevate form over substance.
To some extent, I would agree with that, Your Honor. But again, when there is not a clear rule about what a separate statutory offense is, and again, the state argues that they're separate, that they are not separate statutory offenses because it's different manners and means. But I don't know that it's different manners and means, because it's not so much the manners and means of the possession about how he possessed the gun. It's a where and it's a time and a place. And so I'm not so sure, and frankly, I don't know exactly how the Court of Criminal Appeals ultimately straightens out the issue of, in a conduct offense, what is manners and means. I would argue that in this case, when you have the conduct and what you're talking about is circumstances in time, that it perhaps is separate statutory offenses. For example, if Mr. Gilbert had possessed the gun, let's say this happened in the fourth year after his release. He's guilty under one of the provisions no matter what, but if it's outside the 5 years, he's only guilty if he's away from his home. And I think that shows that these are, in fact, separate statutory offenses. And that's why the only case I could find that even remotely addressed this is the Burleson case out of Waco. They don't go into this analysis of whether 4601A1 and 2 are separate offenses, but if you just look at the way the court talks about the statute, and when you read the statute, I think it shows they're separate offenses. If these are separate statutory offenses, then regardless of whether they were labeled as counts or paragraphs, they have to be treated as counts. And if the court doesn't have any other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Ms. Faulkner?
May it please the court. I represent the state in this appeal. And as Justice Livingston correctly pointed out, in order for this to be two separate offenses, it would have had to be proper for appellant to be convicted under both A1 and A2. And I think we'd be here on a different point of error if the court had charged these on counts and the appellant would have been convicted on both. The indictment did set forth two manner and means as counts. The cases cited, Gall and Riley, say that the mislabeling in the indictment does not transform paragraphs into counts. And the trial court was required to give a correct charge on the law, and the correct charge on the law was to set these forth in the disjunctive as paragraphs. And the case that Mr. Wynn referred to, the Landrian case that came out on October 8th, there's a lot of stuff in there that doesn't apply. But one thing that the opinion does say is that yet another way of testing whether the state charged one aggravated assault or two distinct and separate aggravated assaults is to ask whether the state could have obtained two aggravated assault convictions stemming from appellant's criminal conduct. Here we had one possession and two ways that the state alleged that that possession violated section 46.04. And the jury was not required to unanimously agree on the manner and means in which defendant's single act violated the statute.
Is it a problem, though, that perhaps under the facts as they were brought forth in the trial of this case, that A1 and A2 were mutually exclusive under these facts? In other words, it either was before or after the five-year period, depending on how the facts came out in the case?
Well, no objection was raised on that ground, but and appellant's not challenging the sufficiency. Under the language of the charge, I think that the jury was not the language of the charge was, I think, that if the defendant had possessed the firearm, I just don't think it's a problem.
Well, I mean, can two different manner and means be inconsistent?
The state can allege two manner and means, and one can be, they can be mutually exclusive, I think, and the jury can determine which one was proven. You know, no objection was raised on that ground, and appellant hasn't challenged the sufficiency. I think that would be more of a sufficiency problem if it were raised that the jury could not have found one of the alternative manner and means. Unless the court has any further questions, the state would pray that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wynn?
I was frantically looking for the Code of Criminal Procedure site, and it's Article 2124 of the Code of Criminal Procedure that sets forth the labeling of counts and paragraphs, and it's actually entitled Joinder of Certain Offenses, but it's where we learn, as set out in Callens, that when something is labeled, that counts are supposed to set forth separate offenses and paragraphs are supposed to set forth different manners and means. And I think you've really touched on the real problem in this case. Is time and place a manners and means? And I'm not so sure that it is. I mean, I think manners and means goes to the actual conduct. In a murder case, for example, you can charge someone with intentionally knowingly causing the death. That's the single statutory offense. And then by, and their non-statutory terms after that, hitting them over the head with a baseball bat, shooting them with a gun, or stabbing them. And those can certainly be submitted in the disjunctive because they're manners and means that go to the actual actus reus. In this case, what we have is the actus reus is the possession, and it talks about a separate thing, about a time and place. And I think under those circumstances, you have separate offenses. If you have separate statutory offenses and you accept the analysis that whether they're labeled, how they're labeled really doesn't matter, if they're separate statutory offenses, then we're still right. So I think the real issue, while I think the fact that the way they're labeled indicates that they are separate statutory offenses, certainly that's the way everyone treated them, the real issue is statutorily are 4601A1 and 4601A2, are those separate statutory offenses, or are those separate manners and means to commit a single statutory offense? And quite frankly, I think the law, the law on this issue, there's not much out there, if anything, to tell you how that works. And our position is that when you start talking about time and place and the circumstances under which a person does a certain act, that's not manners and means, though it makes them separate statutory offenses. And again, the only case that I could find that even remotely addresses this is the Waco Court of Appeals case, and in the introductory paragraph, they talk about the statutory elements of an offense under 4601A1 are, and the statutory elements of an offense under 4601A2 are. And in this case, it kind of does make a difference. I mean, this shows our offense date is May 13th of 2006. The judgment and conviction, State's Exhibit 9, which is the prior conviction record that they used to prove the underlying felony, shows that he was convicted of a state jail on August 2nd of 2001. I don't think we know from the record how much time, when Mr. Gilbert was released from that sentence. And so we don't know if it was within 5 years. If he was at a point where he pled in 2001, where he almost had 2 years in, who knows?
So, again, that's a sufficiency question, though.
Well, I think it goes to deciding. It shows the difference between the two statutory offenses and why it was important to have a jury tell us which one they thought he was guilty of. I mean, frankly, we can't really, without a unanimous verdict, we can't make an effective sufficiency sufficiency challenge, even if there was one to make, because it was submitted in the disjunctive, he'd be guilty under either theory. And he certainly, they could make an argument, since he was away from home, would be guilty under either theory. But that's really the evil of not submitting it so that we get a particular verdict on the statutory offense. If the court has no further questions, we ask the case be reversed.
Thank you both for appearing here this morning to present your arguments. The case is submitted, and you're both excused.